We'll take a brief moment to overview chapter 8. There are some significant transitions that take place. We'll talk for just a moment about, most primarily, you won't notice this since we're all using English Bibles. However, if you were to go back and look at the original manuscripts, then what you find in Daniel chapter 8 is the transition from the Aramaic, which was chapters 2 through 7, to the Hebrew, which will be chapter 8 and conclude with the end of the book, chapter 12, as we have them broken down. Aramaic was the common language of the day, and when you look at the content of chapters 2 through 7, that portion of Daniel that was written in Aramaic, the message was by and large not solely for the Israelites, but more so for all of the nations in that period and in that time. Chapter 2 was the dream of the four kingdoms. That was the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks and finally the Romans. And all of the nations in this area that would be impacted, that was the revealing of that dream. In chapters 3 through 6, you kind of have the record of events that's going on in Babylon. You've got Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. More so, those aren't focusing solely on the Hebrew people, but rather just the events of Babylon at large. In chapter 7, once again, you've got that vision that points toward these four kingdoms that are coming, going to be impacting many of the nations in this area. And all of that is written in the Aramaic. Now, in chapter 8, we're going to move from the broad focus of the nations, if you will, and we're going to look specifically at things that are pertaining to God's people, that is the Jews. And so it makes perfect sense for Daniel to revert back to the language of God's special people. This idea of the changing language is caused scholars to really question the validity of the book of Daniel. They've wondered, well, why did the author change languages just midway through the text? And it's caused them once again to say, well, that must mean that there are multiple authors in the book, and that removes the consistency and the validity of this actually being a book that was written by Daniel the prophet. But this idea of transitioning from Aramaic to Hebrew, it isn't unique to the book of Daniel. In fact, you've got the book of Jeremiah, which was written almost entirely in Hebrew with the exception of one verse. It's written in Aramaic. And you look at the contents of that one verse, and it helps you understand why it may be the author transitions languages from time to time. It's Jeremiah 10 and 11, the sole Aramaic verse in the book of Jeremiah, which was a book that was given almost unanimously to God's people. He says, "Thus you shall say to them, the gods that did not make the heavens and the earth will perish from the earth and from under the heavens." And if you think about all of the surrounding nations that would be steeped in idolatry, this is a message from the God of heaven to those people. And it's not written in Hebrew because it's not solely directed at the Israelites. It's directed to all nations that worship these false gods and the impending judgment that's going to fall upon them if they continue in pursuit of those things. And so you've got that sole verse in Jeremiah where, if you will, God, the God of heaven, is proclaiming to all the nations, you need to put your idols away. You need to turn to the God of heaven. So you've got that change in language that's noticeable in Daniel chapter 8. You'll probably notice that as we're looking at these dreams, we've got a lot of similar elements from chapter 7 and chapter 8. You've got world powers that are depicted as these ferocious beasts. And you'll remember early in chapter 7, the four beasts that are described there. We're going to be introduced to two more beasts today that represent what we're going to find out as world powers. And both of those beasts culminate with this picture of a tyrant that's described as a little horn. And we'll be looking into that in Daniel 8. They both have very similar elements between chapters 7 and 8. As I said before, we're moving really from the broad picture, which we had in chapter 7, the four upcoming nations and the hundreds of years of history that would transpire over the period of the fulfillment of that dream, to a much more narrow scope of history. We're kind of taking a step forward and we're focusing on a single aspect of that, a couple of dynasties in particular that we'll talk about when we get to chapter 8. So the scope of what we're examining is going to condense very much. Lastly, we wouldn't once again know this, you may notice that the chapter 8's English is kind of a little harder to read than maybe some of the other, maybe you didn't notice it just a whole lot. Well, what we know based off of the original manuscripts, and scholars can tell us this, is that the quality of Hebrew in chapters 8 through 12 is inferior to the quality of Aramaic, which the writer was obviously more comfortable with as he was writing. When you look at other books that are contemporary to Daniel, like Ezra and Nehemiah, the quality of Hebrew behind our English of chapters 8 through 12 is inferior to that. And so there have been some who said, well, once again, that's indicative of the fact that this man didn't know what he was talking about, this transition in language, this poor quality Hebrew. Any thoughts on that, why that might have been? Maybe why the quality of the Hebrew dropped off. I know that's kind of a technical question, but I think that it makes perfect sense when you consider certain aspects.
One thing, the whole Hebrew nation was in disarray. They were scattered everywhere. The scholarly ones were, not just grouped together somewhere like in Jerusalem, like they were. So that possibly
could be. Okay. So you had the nation of the Hebrews, which were in complete disarray. But you think about Daniel's life. Right, and what we're going to find out about chapter 8 is it occurred during the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. Daniel's going to be probably close to 70 years old. So where did he spend the majority of his life? Been in Babylon. What was he instructed immediately when he got to Babylon in?
The
Chaldean language, the Aramaic language. And in service to the king, he wouldn't be speaking Hebrew as a representative of the nation of Babylon. Hebrew would not be a tongue that he would be speaking. He would be speaking Aramaic, that is the language of diplomacy. Or he would be speaking Chaldean, which was a language that the Babylonians spoke. And so the reality is, and you consider, we've got one account where he brushes up with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and very likely spoke to them in the Hebrew language because that would be an opportunity to speak his native language. But he spent the majority of his time speaking these other languages. And anybody that's taken any other language, maybe back in high school they've taken Spanish or French or something like that. And if that's not something you practice regularly, what happens? You get rusty. You may remember fragments and pieces of it, but you're by no means going to be fluent. And very likely when it comes to the Daniel's life, as he transitioned from speaking Hebrew to primarily Aramaic or Chaldean, his Hebrew is just very frankly going to get rusty because he wasn't going to have a lot of opportunity to practice that. And so when you look at it in that context, really what that evidence shows us is very reflective on the truth of what we know about Daniel's life. That is, he probably didn't spend a lot of time speaking the Hebrew language. And so when he sits down to write this message and God instructs him to record these visions for his people in the Hebrew language, Daniel's Hebrew isn't really up to scratch. He's more comfortable in the Aramaic because he's been writing and speaking and communicating in Aramaic for 45, 50 years. And so it makes perfect sense when you consider the events that are transpiring in Daniel's life. So what we'll notice, kind of a little breakdown of the chapter, there are two parts. In verses 1 through 14, you've got Daniel receiving the vision. And in verses 15 through 27, you've got the explanation of the vision. So let's jump into the chapter and read verses 1 through 8 to start with. Jimmy Dale, would you read that for us, please?
In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me. To me, Daniel, after the first one that appeared to me the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven.
Okay, so we have Daniel's vision of this two-horned ram and this goat with a very, what Daniel uses to describe as a noticeable horn, a conspicuous horn, something to that effect. And there's just a little image of perhaps what it was Daniel saw as he's transported and as he witnesses this vision. But verse 1 tells us that we are in the third year of Belshazzar, who was king of Babylon. The previous vision in chapter 7 took place in the first year of Belshazzar. So this occurs a couple of years later, puts Daniel's age at about 70. So about this time, what's taking place historically, you've got Babylon, who is the world power for the moment. That their reign of terror, however, is going to come to an end. You kind of have Babylon there in the red, Egypt down there in the southeast, and the Persian Empire. What's taking place here in Persia, taking place historically at this time, you've got King Cyrus of the Persians, who has made somewhat of an alliance with the Medes. And Babylon's sitting there wondering, you can see the size and the girth of the great Persian Empire at this point in time. Babylon's wondering what's about to happen. As he's noticed that the Medes and the Persians have made allies with one another, are they going to soon attack us? Are they going to try to overthrow the power that we have? And Nabonidus, in an attempt to counter this, he's gone up to Lydia and he's tried to make allies with Lydia. And he's tried to make allies with Egypt down in the southeast. And he wasn't able to do so. The whole world was watching at this point in time to really see what was going to happen as Cyrus has amassed this great alliance between the Medes and the Persians. And perhaps his vision was given so that the Jews would know, we're currently given captivity in Babylon. What's going to happen if Babylon falls? Are we going to be destroyed? Is the nation that comes in that's greater than them going to destroy us? And so maybe this vision is, which is going to point beyond the years of the Babylonian Empire, to, as we're going to see, the Persian and then later the Greek, maybe this was to reassure them, in part, that they were going to persist despite the fact that the Babylonian Empire was going to fall. And Daniel was located or transported, he's talking about, to witness this vision right there to Susa. Susa, or Shushan, you may notice it says Shushan, and you may recall the name of that from the book of Esther. The book of Esther is when the Persian nation and the Persian Empire really enters into the forefront of world history, and we know that that's where the palace was at in the book of Esther, which King Ahasuerus resided at and where Esther was brought to live. And Shushan was initially part of the Elamites, which is there on eastern Babylon. 2,000 or 3,000 years before, the Elamites had been this great and mighty nation, and they had developed a very somewhat sophisticated culture for the day and time. And they were a very warlike people. Periodically, they would threaten and attack the Assyrians and then later the Babylonians. And Susa was the capital of the province of Elam. Now, Ashurbanipal, during the days of the Assyrians, attacked and really all but destroyed the Elamites. And so they were no longer relevant at this point in time in history. However, Susa was the capital, prominent city of the province of the Elamites. And so Daniel's describing this vision that he sees, and he describes in verse 3 this two-horned ram. Anyone want to guess what the two-horned ram represents? Okay. Why do you think it's described this way? You know, we've seen a lot of symbolism here regarding the horns, and this particular ram had two horns, right? Representative of the two nations, as Paul has just said. The Medo-Persian Empire, and you go back and you look at history, and it's kind of neat to see how history is corroborated. Once again, everything we read here in the Bible, the Persians used somewhat of a mascot, if you will, for their nation and their great army, the ram. One of the kings, in fact, was said to have gone to battle with a ram's head and ram's skin over his head, and that's how he led his people into battle. That's how he led the nation into battle. And the rams were representative, kind of like the lions were representative of the Babylonians. The ram was representative of the Medo-Persian alliance and collaboration. These two horns, we're told that one was greater than the other. Why do you think that might be?
I think
Okay. Remember back in chapter 7, what was the representative, what beast was the representation of the Medo-Persians in chapter 7? Do you remember? Was the bear. The bear that had the three ribs in his mouth. And you go back and you read chapter 7, what you find out, Daniel describes this bear, it raises up on one side. You know, meaning, as I think we see here, you've got the Medo-Persians is represented by these two horns, one horn being larger than the other. As was said, you've got the Persians that are really going to arrive as the dominant. The alliance between the Medes and the Persians is soon going to be dissolved. The Persians are going to be the one that rise up and become the ruling power for all intents and purposes. And so that's why Daniel describes the two nations as the bear rising up on one side and having two horns here, but excuse me, one horn being greater than the other. That would be the Persian Empire that really outgrew and outshined the Median Empire. So you notice here also, as Persia has arrived as the greater empire, this great ram is described as butting westward, northward, and southward. And it seems he's butting in all directions. But when you read through that and you look at that, well, he's not butting eastward. Well, if you look at really what's to the east of the Persian Empire, look how greatly they were expanded there to the east. And so this great ram, which represents the two, think of this idea of a ram butting. Well, that's a very warlike action. That's how rams fight. That's how they defend themselves. That's how they attack. So they use their horns and they'll butt other animals or they'll butt other rams. And so you've got this ram in this vision that's butting in north, south, west. And if you think, you've got here, and this follows with what we find that history shows us regarding the reign of the Persian Empire. You've got there to the north, you've got Scythia, which the Persians were for a time at war with. And down to the south, you hear the Bible talk about the south. The people of the south almost always are talking about the Egyptians. You've got it butting southward down there, making war with the Egyptians. You've got it butting westward. You've got it in war against the Babylonians, who are directly to the west. And they've already expanded their kingdom toward the east. And remember, this hasn't happened yet. This is going to occur. It hasn't happened yet. And so during its heyday, what Daniel is describing of this two-horned ram would be taking place. They would be making war and expanding their borders to the north, the west, and the south, and growing in all of those directions. And as he describes here, no one's able to withstand the ram. You know, oftentimes, you may notice that he's going to bring in another character, that is this male goat, and the male goat has what the New American Standard refers to, or maybe that's just my insertion, to help bring some clarity. I think the New American Standard says that this male goat has what's called a conspicuous horn. Go back, I think the intent of the original word is to say that it was noticeable. That is, you look at it, the horn stands out. And so this male goat comes up into the picture that Daniel sees, and he's got this noticeable horn. And male goats are representative for princes. You go over to Zechariah 10:3, and you find out where God is speaking. It says, "My anger is kindled against the shepherds, and I will punish the male goats." He's not talking about literal animals. He's talking about the house of Judah, and I'll make them like a majestic horse in battle. He's talking about the princes, the rulers of that people. And so you've got here this goat that's representative of what we're going to come to find out is Greece. And Daniel actually identifies these elements for us later on in the chapter, verses 20 and 21. And so you've got here Greece and Persia kind of at the center stage. And you look at verse 5. Says that this beast is this goat is coming from the west. Well, I think I had my map up here just a second ago. You can kind of see to the west of the Persian Empire is Greece. And so that's who Daniel's identifying as this male goat here in this particular chapter. It says this goat's moving with swiftness without touching the ground. That's kind of running without touching the ground indicates how swiftly this Grecian army was going to move. And if you'll remember, Nebuchadnezzar, he's referred to as swiftly acquiring the lands and swiftly conquering the nations. This Grecian empire, Grecian army, was going to do so much more swiftly than the Babylonians or the Medo-Persians. And so that's why this ghost described as being running without touching the ground or moving without touching the ground. He's coming very swiftly to make war against this ram. So any thoughts real quick before we talk specifically about it? What that conspicuous horn might be, or who that conspicuous horn might be. Think so? Anybody else agree with that? You don't agree with that? You're just saying that to...
She's a father. I can't remember his father.
Philip of Macedon?
Yeah.
Was it? Okay. Yeah. I guess I would go with the crowd. Sorry, Dick. I would say it seems to me that it's Alexander the Great. And, you know, you could stop and you could see... because as it's going to be identified later, the conspicuous horn is going to be the first king of the nation. And Philip of Macedon, you've got kind of got Alexander the Great that unites both the Greeks and the Macedonians. And the horn is being described as the first king. And so Philip was king of Macedon, Alexander the Great's father. But Alexander the Great was the one that united them. And he was the one that really expanded the borders and the greatness of the Grecian Empire. Now, there might be some argumentation. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that on Philip of Macedon and his accomplishments. But I believe, personally, that the horn that's described there is none other than Alexander the Great. Well, got too far ahead on my charts. And so what Daniel witnesses now in this dream between this ram and between this goat is this great battle that takes place. And it's really impressive to see how Daniel is going to describe specific details of what history is going to record for us regarding these two nations. For instance, it was the goat that was making its way toward the ram. You know, the ram didn't pick the fight with the goat. This goat's running toward this ram, and as you see it describe it, it just attacks it. You read this and you just get this idea that, man, this goat really has it out for this ram. Because he gores them, and he tramples them down, and he just beats them to a pulp. Really, as you read through the text there, it's obvious that it's almost something personal between these two. And that's exactly what happened. In 334, these Grecian forces that were united under Alexander the Great, they really hurled themselves against the Persian Empire under the leadership of Alexander. And as you read what Daniel is witnessing, it's obvious that this goat's got it for this ram. It's not that he just wants to defeat him and usurp his position. He wants to utterly just remove this guy from the face of the earth. You see, this isn't the first time that these two world powers have collided. You go back to 490, and you've got where Greece invaded Thrace. And you've got there what's known as the Battle of Marathon. A little bit later, a very famous battle that we've no doubt heard of, 480 BC, Persia attacks Greece again, and you've got what we know as the Battle of Thermopylae. And so this isn't the first time that these Greek and Persian armies have butted up against each other. And you might say as a result of that, this really instilled within the Greeks a hatred for these Persian people because they attacked unprovoked twice against the Grecian nation. And so as a result of that, this really has stoked the fires of anger of the Grecians against that of the Persians. And what's going to happen when you read about the last time these forces, these two nations meet, you've got Alexander the Great who crosses, comes from the west and crosses and invades into Persia, he and his army, and they attack, I believe it's Darius, don't quote me on that. Yeah, they attack Darius, and here at the Battle of Arbela, stomp them. So Darius and the Persian army, they retreat to the area of Bactria there. Well, guess what? Alexander the Great and the Grecians, they chase them all the way there. They engage them there again at Bactra. They beat them again. And so the Persians, once again, they run to this area of Sogdiana, however you say that. And they try to retreat there. Well, here comes the Greeks again. And they just, time after time after time, this relentless pursuit of Alexander the Great to just destroy these Persian people. And it goes back to, once again, the unprovoked attacks of the Persians on the Greeks. But this is what Daniel's describing. This goat, you go back and you read that. He came without touching the ground. Verse 7, I saw him come beside the ram. He was enraged at him. He struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. He hurled him to the ground, and he trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. And so he doesn't just remove this ram from power. He beats the ram down. And that's exactly what happens whenever you look at history and you see this is what Alexander the Great and the Grecians did to the Persians. It was just a relentless assault, battle after battle after battle, until the two horns, the power of the ram, essentially, was shattered. And the Persian Empire came to be very little. Verses 6 and 7 describe what history later tells us took place between these two nations. You've got there the breaking of the big horn, which... I believe we can, once again, I believe this corroborates the evidence that this bighorn is indeed Alexander the Great. In fact, almost to the point where among most of the scholars, it's uncontested. You wonder a lot of times as Daniel's talking, well, who's he referring to? Who's this horn representative of? And so we're left guessing, kind of like we were back in chapter 7 with the little horn being Domitian. There's some evidence that points to it that would lead you to that conclusion, but you can't say with any absolute certainty. You get over here to this big horn that this goat has, and almost certainly it's Alexander the Great. Once again, part of the reason that we have evidence for that. The horn, verse 8, the goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, this great horn, as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. And in his place, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds. And so you've got this goat which has defeated this ram, and he's made himself exceedingly great. And then all of a sudden, whenever he reaches the peak of his power, as it seems, this horn breaks off. So it's almost about certain. There's a nice little bust of Alexander the Great's head to give you an idea of what he might have looked like. And what history tells us about Alexander the Great, did he live to a ripe old age?
No.
He died young, didn't he? Died a very young man, 33 years old, very unexpectedly. At the age of 33, it seems that a fever ended up taking his life. And so you've got him, Alexander, who was the head of this Grecian army, and for 10 years really expanded the nation, or expanded the empire to that which was the world power at that point in time. While he was very strong, the horn broke. Alexander the Great died in his youth when it seemed he would have many years ahead of him. And as a result, what arose as a result of him breaking this horn, great horn breaking, or Alexander the Great in his youth dying, these four conspicuous horns came up in the place of the one. And so, well, since Alexander the Great didn't leave an heir, what we do know, there were these four what are called as the Diadochi. They arose after his death. And they were generals, prominent people during the days of Alexander the Great, prominent people that arose during his administration. And you've kind of got, and this is just the four that really arose as prominent. There were multiple Diadochi. There were actually more than four, but what arose as a result of this essentially was four divisions of the Grecian Empire. And so you can see as they've taken over Persia. So you've got Seleucus, who was somewhat, he's going to be relevant later on in the chapter. You've got Seleucus, who had the largest part of what was Persia, and now the Grecian domain, and he was king over that area there. You've got Ptolemy, who Alexander the Great, when he went down into Egypt and he conquered some of the land there, you got Ptolemy, who was king of this portion of the Grecian Empire. Lysimachus, I guess is how you say that, had this area there of Greece, and then Cassander off to the west where Greece originally came from, that particular area of Macedonia. So it plays out exactly like Daniel was saying. You've got this great horn that's broken, and as a result of that, four conspicuous horns come up in his place. And what we find out is that this is really setting the stage. What Daniel's doing here for us is for a purpose. He's bringing us to the Greek people for a particular reason, and we're definitely not going to get to that this week. We'll read more about Daniel's purpose and kind of giving you a small portion of what was going to take place historically. You'll understand Daniel setting the stage that he's bringing us to a particular point in time. So, this is really impressive when you consider what Daniel's done. We read this, and we can go back, and we're looking at it from the front end of the spectrum. That is, we know all of these things have happened. However, Daniel, as he's speaking these things, and he's giving these details of what will transpire between the Medo-Persians and the Grecians, and how historically that's going to play out, is pointing towards something that's going to be very relevant in the lives of God's people, that is the lives of the Jews. And it's going to make a major impact on the people of God in the upcoming years. Does anyone have any thoughts or comments, questions on verses 1 through 8 that we've looked at? Any of the symbolism that may have been there? Any of the history maybe that I've confused or that you have a question about? Any of that? You'll notice the difference between chapter 7 and 8. We were left with a lot of uncertainty, and When we get over to chapter 9, there's going to be a whole lot of uncertainty that we really find as we seek to interpret Daniel's dreams and Daniel's visions. But chapter 8 gives us a relatively clear picture. We can look at that. We can look at what Daniel says. We can compare that to history, and we can see that we can identify specific elements of this dream much easier than we could some of those of chapter 7 or some of those in the upcoming chapters. So chapter 11, you're also going to see, is going to tie in very strongly to what's taking place here, or what's being foretold by Daniel in chapter 8. So we've got, you know, just about out of time. Let's just read the next portion of the book, and then we'll bring our class to a close. Beginning in verse 9 of Daniel 8. Out of them, these four conspicuous horns that came up, out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. It grew up to the hosts of heaven, and caused some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice. And it will fling the truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one in particular who was speaking, "How long will the vision about the regular sacrifices apply? While the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled." He said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored." So, rather confusing when you read all of that, but I promise, I hope we're going to make very clear some of the elements and some of the things that Daniel's talking about. These stars that are being cast down by this goat and being trampled by this goat, and the daily sacrifice being removed. I hope we're able to bring some clarity to that next week.